Welcome to another episode of Spotlight with Shubham. I'm co-founder of Mestera, an all-in-one platform for coaches and trainers to run and scale their online knowledge business. Today on Spotlight, we have Eliza with us. She's a speaker, writer, and author of the best-selling book, A Woman's Guide to Claiming Space, Stand Tall, Raise Your Voice, Be Heard. Welcome, Eliza.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Absolutely. Looking forward to the conversation and digging into your book and a lot of other things for the listeners today. With that, tell us about yourself and how you got started, how you wrote the book, and your journey till here.
Well, my journey was kind of a complex one. I had a really wonderful childhood that started quite well. And then my mother became paranoid schizophrenic. And there was a lot of trauma that happened. And I ended up at a certain point being so traumatized because my mother actually kidnapped me that I started to conflate invisibility with safety. And so I started to make myself really invisible. And eventually I kind of clawed my way out of that. But then in my 40s, I was hit by a car while somebody was texting and driving and I was riding my bike and I lost my ability to communicate. And so I had to sort of build that up just bit by bit by bit. And eventually I sort of cracked the HTML of communication. And I started, I've had kind of a very interesting road to get here. So I was in political science and then I went to law school. Then I took a leave of absence, never went back, did an acting program, was an acting teacher. And then I ran an acting school for that I founded for over 20 years. So, but all my work has to do with basically the intersection of your physicality and your voice with the socio-political. So why is it that one person says something one way and someone else says it the same way and they're received quite differently? And how do you mitigate that in the workplace? So after my accident, I had learned so much. And so I started working with people and working more and more. And the next thing I knew, you know, I was working a lot. And then I was giving talks and workshops and it just sort of went from there, and eventually a book evolved out of it.
That's quite a journey, and thanks for sharing that. I'm sure there were a lot of learnings and sort of discovering yourself during that journey.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. So with that, let's dig right into your book. I'm really curious and really want to talk about that. So with that, tell us about it. What is it about? And any takeaways that you want to share from your book with our listeners?
Okay. Well, my book, I will hold it up shamelessly. But this is my book. It's A Woman's Guide to Claiming Space. We actually had the picture done during the pandemic, which was crazy. Everybody was in hazmat suits and it was wild, but we did it. My book is basically how do women claim space. So when I was recovering from my accident, I noticed that some people would walk in the room and they would just command attention and other people really wouldn't. And I thought, what is the one thing that makes one person just command so much attention? Everybody's listening to them and engaging with them and they're persuasive and their career is going well. And other people are sort of receding back into the wall and people aren't really noticing them and they're having trouble speaking up in meetings. And I noticed there were five things, there were five aspects. And because I was hoping there was a silver bullet, but of course there's never a silver bullet. Yeah. So these five aspects were sort of rattling around in my head and I'll tell you about them in a second. And then after I started giving my talks on communication, women would follow me to the bathroom. And they'd be like, I got to ask you a question I didn't want to ask in Q&A. Mm-hmm. And then they would ask the question. And it didn't matter if I was in Hong Kong or Texas or New York or Florida. It just didn't matter. It was the same probably 50 questions. And eventually I realized that those 50 questions fell into the five buckets of claiming space. and that these were conversations that were happening in the bathroom, but they really needed to be brought into the sunlight. And that was my goal for the book. So the five aspects of claiming space and the what I have found to be sort of the magic formula, not if people are going to master them, because I don't think that's possible, but to be mindful of them throughout their lives, which really helps them claim space, are as follows. And just to kind of summarize what claiming space means to me, claiming space is to live the life of your choosing unapologetically and bravely. And to me, bravery isn't a lack of fear, because who, you know, that's not really brave. if you're not afraid and you're doing something, where is that brave? But what bravery is to me is being scared to death and doing something anyway. So the first thing is physicality and voice. Do they have a lot of control over how they move their bodies in space? And are they reactive or are they mindful? The second thing is community building. Do they have a really good community around them? We call it networking. I like to call it community building. And do they have anti-mentors in their life who are poisoning their community? And have they learned to mitigate the damage of those anti-mentors? The next one is, what kind of burden are they carrying with them, like with from their past? And is that getting in the way of what they're doing in their life? So is it a big boulder that they're carrying with them? Or have they taken the hard things in their life and reduced them to a pebble? I don't think you can get rid of them. I think that's a lie. But and kind of put them in their pocket and go, okay, that happened. And I learned from that. And that's good. But I don't have to have it weigh me down. The next one is, how do you protect yourself from aggressors? So microaggressions, mansplaining, things like that, and bullying, sexual harassment. And the final one is, are they intersectional? And what I mean by that is, women who hung out with women who didn't look like them exclusively tended to do better. And I think that's because there you have to have a certain level of humility to hang out with people who aren't like you, because you're going to mess up. And so you have to be open to learning and growing. And those women were. And so those five aspects, if people could be mindful of them, and that's how I coach, and that's what I give my talks and workshops on, all of those five aspects, then they actually tended to be incredibly successful in not just their career, but in their personal life.
Thank you. No, that's great. And how you sort of talked about the whole sort of those five bullets and with your massive experience there. It's interesting because the last part that you touched on was sort of the mindset thing. And that's what I was sort of thinking about, that a lot of people, even though they will read about it and somewhere or something, they may not know that they need help on this thing. They have anti-mentors and things like that. So I think that awareness and mindset turns out to be a key starting point, I believe, for anyone who wants to even work and execute these things. Is that what you have seen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I've found in general when people are trying to really have forward movement in their life is they have to learn. And to learn, there are five aspects of learning, actually. I'll break them down to less. But basically, the first thing is, you don't know what you don't know. Then you know what you don't know, but you can't do it. Then you can do it if you really, really think about it. And then you can do it, you know, without thinking about it at all. And then finally, it just becomes quite natural to you. And it's just a part of your life. You don't even realize you're doing it. And I think that the not knowing is when you're not mindful. And as soon as you get to stage two, even though that's an incredibly frustrating stage, because you don't know it, you know what you don't know, but you can't do it. That's when real growth happens. That's mindfulness.
Got it. And any suggestions or any thoughts there that how someone can sort of get to that? Is it mostly sort of surrounding yourself with that sort of information, content, people, that kind of thing? Or how do people navigate to that? Because that to me is that big chasm kind of thing, which sometimes people probably don't even navigate and sort of fall back.
Well, I think there are two things. I mean, the first thing, obviously, I wrote a book about it.
So
I'm like, get my book. And the book, actually, a lot of men who've read it and people of all genders have said that it helped them. I'd say it's probably 30 to 40% specific to women, and the rest is really for anybody. For example, the chapter on anti-mentors is not gender specific. But the other thing I think is that so we're sort of in a culture right now where there is a lot of focus on what is being done to you. And I see that a lot with white feminism in particular, a sort of victim stance of like, these things are being done to us. And I think that gets in the way of understanding that sometimes you are also part of the, not problem, but you need to make some changes yourself. So if you are in a place, I've heard white women say, for example, you know, I don't understand because, you know, I deal with this wage and discrepancy and they're not realizing that maybe they're not being wonderful to a woman who's a coworker who's Black. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of that is just really understanding that in every interaction, you need to do things differently. And the other person probably needs to do things differently, but it's never just the other person. And if you can start to kind of reflect on yourself, that's when you start to realize where your blind spots are and where you can learn and grow. And for me, it's really important not to think of it as a good or bad, like you're being bad or you're being good, but it's more, where are my blind spots? And if I can kind of learn what they are and be open to it when people tell me, how do I then move forward and do it differently?
Yeah, makes sense. And on that, you talked about during the initial part, you talked about that presence that a lot of people don't have, that and that fear thing, and sitting on the side, not able to speak up. And then you gave the example that a lot of folks were sort of following you. Because they could have asked that question. I was thinking that they could have asked that question in public, but they didn't. But I think that's where that little bit of fear kind of thing is. And I've experienced that personally as well. So curious to talk about it, that do you see that mostly in minorities, women, and that kind of thing? Or is it pretty much across the board? And it's more of a mindset sort of thing, which is pretty much across the board, any country, any geo, sort of thing.
Well, I think all of us struggle with imposter syndrome to a certain extent, but there are certain demographics that are sort of taught that is your space to be in. You are, you know, you walk in a space and you're just expected to be in that space. So for example, I was coaching somebody who was trying to get money from venture capitalists. And so he asked that I come with him to one of the big meetings. And we went into the huge building in New York City. On the first floor was all people of color. We go to the second floor. It was way up high. We go finally to the place we were going. I don't know what floor was high. And there was a white woman waiting for us to take us down to meet this person. And all of the offices were glass on one side. So you could look in. I swear this was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So things have definitely changed a little. I didn't see one white woman or a person of color the entire walk. And we get in the room and there's a 24-year-old child. I mean, I'm a mom. So I'm like, hey, you're only a couple of years older than my child. Right. And he's like, oh, I just have a small account. It's several billion, whatever, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, he just felt like this was his place to be. And he was totally comfortable. And he felt, of course, I'm here. Of course, I'm talking to these older people. And this one guy who happens to be one of the foremost experts in the world on internet security, of course. And I actually don't think that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's good to go in a room and think, of course, I should be here. I'm qualified. But some groups are taught, you know, of course, you can be here. And some groups are taught, you know, maybe you're not really, really supposed to be here, or there just aren't enough of you that we're thinking about your needs. And so I think that to feel belonging makes you feel a little less imposter syndrome. So I do think that people of color, white women, particularly in certain parts of our of society, struggle with that a little bit more. But I also work with a lot of white male introverts. Mm-hmm. And they struggle too. So I think if you're not fitting into a very rigid sort of normative expectation of how you're supposed to behave, whether it's you're supposed to be an extrovert and you're supposed to process and lead like an extrovert, or you're supposed to be a tall white guy or whatever, it's harder. I think it's harder. That does not mean it's impossible at all. And it also doesn't mean it's anyone's fault. It's just this systemic system. If you start out with everybody being one way, it's going to be hard to integrate when people start to do it differently. I mean, it would be hard for me if every time I walked in a room was all white women. And suddenly I had to let in like white men. I'd be like, what are you doing here? Right. I think it's just a human response, but we got to work on it, you know?
No, that makes sense. And that sort of goes back to sort of our conditioning as well. So it's a societal sort of conditioning that growing up and sort of working and seeing things around, and we start to sort of just accept that thing as this is the normal. And if something is not looking like normal, and that's where I think, to your point, imposter syndrome and things like that sort of starts to kick in, that why am I not like that of thing.
And I think I often people say feel imposter syndrome, and then we start digging in and they're the only demographic of X in their office, and I always say, are you feeling like you have imposter syndrome, or do you feel like maybe the situation is making you feel like an imposter? Because those are two different things. And one really cool example of this is my son, actually, who, if you look at him, he seems like he's just in the demographic. He's a tall, good-looking white guy. He's straight. He has all the things. He's from his father's a doctor. Like, you know, you can't really align someone better with like privilege than he. But he was born with severe dyslexia, and he can't read. I mean, and when I say he can't read, you know, he had every intervention. He simply can't read. He listens to maybe 2 to 3 books a week. He's brilliant, but he cannot read. And he finally found a job that's working for him in sales. And he was just in a meeting and he made a joke about being unable to read and dyslexic. And he got a call afterwards from leadership. And they said, Jonah, we didn't know you couldn't read. And we wanted to ask you, would it help you if every time anyone sent you an email or you were included in any email, we all just did a voice dictation and everyone else can just turn on their, you know, their voice to text and read it if they want to, but that would be easier for you. And he called me and said, Mom, it's going to change everything for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't have to pick up on that joke. Right. They didn't have to, you know, notice that it wasn't really a joke, but they did. And now they have a loyal person who will, you know, for life. I mean, this Jonah is absolutely going to stay with this company because they're accommodating him. And I think, he's one of their top salespeople. He could have left and he's choosing to stay. And partly it's because, you know, they are choosing to make him feel like he belongs. And I think belonging is one of the best ways to stop imposter syndrome.
No, that makes sense. And I just yesterday, I was sort of writing about a little bit on the empathy thing, and it kind of just synchronized. It's very much in line what you just said. It's empathy. The leadership really was able to put themselves in the shoes of your son and really kind of think through that. But a lot of organizations, there's no empathy, which I would say 90% of organizations are like that. They would have just, like you, to your point, just heard it and just ignored it, and no kind of an indifference sort of attitude, and that leads to a loyal employee and a very happy workplace. So that definitely kind of goes in line with that.
And you never know anyone's story. I mean, and that's the thing, is we have to be so careful. You know, that everybody does. Most people have a story. I think everyone has a story. And so your job, I think, in the workplace, particularly if you're a boss, is to listen for those stories and not assume that, you know, this young man who was, my son was a three-time, totally bragging, but he was a three-time national collegiate cycling champion. I mean, he just seems like he's just, you know, but he can't read. So you just never know somebody's story. And to pay attention to that is what really makes people want to work for you, want to work hard for you, certainly inoculates you against quiet quitting. So,
right. Absolutely. Awesome. No, thanks for sharing that. That's a great story from the family/your son side. With that, I do want to talk about a little bit of your, we did talk about book. I want to talk about the other things that you do. You're a speaker. You had a lot of speaking engagement. So talk to us, like, when did you decide that, hey, I want to be a speaker, a motivational speaker, and kind of go in that direction? When was that? What happened? Just a little story around that.
Well, it really didn't happen that way. I would love to say, and then I decided to be a motivational speaker, but that's not really what happened. For years before my accident, because of the nature of my work, people had said, hey, can you help me? I'm going to do a speech. Can you help me? I'm having trouble communicating with my boss. Because acting really is about tuning into the minutiae of human behavior, particularly the acting technique that I taught and adapted. And so I was doing a lot of that work, and I suddenly realized, where's my time? And after my accident, it got more intense because I had more knowledge and I just didn't have time. And I looked and wrote out kind of my weekly schedule to figure out what was happening. And I realized I was just giving away for free my expertise. And I wasn't going to have a job. I wasn't going to be able to make a living because I was spending all my time giving away my IP. So basically, I just started saying, okay, from now on, I'm going to charge for this. And then I would work with someone and then they'd say, you know, you should really give a talk to our organization. So I started doing that and it just kept growing. And at a certain point, it was the big difficult transition was, how do I make this a full-time thing? Because it's part-time is hard to do. And so I had to really, what I ended up doing was emailing everyone I'd ever worked with for free and saying, hey, I'm now charging and I've done a lot for a lot of folks. And can you spread the word on this? Right. And that really helped me a lot. And also word of mouth is just everything. So, you know, one person would tell another person would tell another person. And frankly, their communication work, all the kind of work, the spaces that I am in, some people do it really well and some people don't. And so it's just a crapshoot when you hire someone. So really the only way they're going to hire you is if they've heard you and they think you're phenomenal. So thankfully I've had enough people to say she's phenomenal that it just kept growing.
Nice. And so that's how you sort of started initially. So that was the other question that I was going to ask, that when you started to work with clients and the other folks and people, how did you start? Like, as in, how did you get your first customers and sort of clients and that kind of thing? So
at first, definitely it was, you know, I was kind of already doing it for free and then I started charging. But I think the other thing that I did was, as I decided I was going to do this, I started charging more than I thought I really deserved at that point and offering massive discounts for referrals. And so that really helped, because then people would say, well, I can't afford her, but if I send someone to her, then I get this amazing discount. And so that really, really helps. And people would do that for me. But I think most of the time it's relationship building. You just want to make sure everybody you talk to, every time you go to an event, you know, you talk to the person who's running it and say, if you have anyone else, you know, please pass my name on. That's how I've gotten, you know, it's a hard thing to do, especially if you've been trained to be polite and quiet and you shouldn't ask. And you have to really go up to people and be like, hey, give me work.
Right.
But it works, because if people like your work, they want to help you. And absolutely. I think that's something people need to get comfortable with, is just saying, please spread the word about my work.
That makes sense. Yeah. Kind of selling yourself as a coach, as a consultant, I guess that's where a lot of people face the difficulty, because most people who are wanting to be coach are not programmed to be salespeople or marketing people. And I think that's where that first disconnect starts to happen, when someone wants to take that first step, or they're like, hey, I'm not able to find clients because that selling part and networking part is missing most of the time. That's what I personally see when I speak with people and our clients.
Well, you have to just get used to realizing that you're going to kind of throw a lot of mud on the wall and not everything's going to stick, and that's okay.
Right.
You know, and the people who want you are going to be willing to pay. And that was the other thing that was a big deal for me, is learning eventually after my book, for example, I got some advice. People were like, you really need to charge more. You have a best-selling book. And it was hard for me to sort of realize, oh yeah, I can really raise my rates. And so recently I had an organization ask me to come in. The first time I'd worked for them, I had not gotten that much. And this time I asked for 5 times as much. Actually, I asked for 10 times as much. And they just, because why not? And they gave me 5 times as much. And this was only a 3 or 4 year difference. But if you don't ask, you're just not getting it, right, you know? Right. And so you just have to ask. And I always recommend people ask for more than they think they need. And then, you know, nobody expects you to actually ask for what you want on the first try. So you have to think of it as a negotiation. I also have a speaker's bureau that I work through, but I try not to go through them as much as possible because they take 20%.
Gotcha. So that bureau kind of thing will sort of help you get the leads and sort of make the connections through their thing, I guess.
But it takes a while. And actually, I find I get more, I'm with a top bureau, but I still think that I get more from just people who've seen my talks. Just works better. And then also, obviously, being active on social media helps a lot as well.
And you mentioned earlier, you have 250,000 followers on TikTok. That's insane. That's quite a big following there.
I know. My son Lucian said to me, "Mom, you got to do TikTok." And I was like, "I'm not doing TikTok, Lucian. I'm old." What? And he was like, "No, Mom, you got to do it. I'm telling you, it's the thing." So eventually I started doing it, but I posted like once every 4 months, which of course the algorithm just ignores you. And then eventually I thought, you know, I'm just going to start posting the stuff from my book and just saying it in little bits. Mm-hmm. And it just started taking off. And it's definitely helped.
Nice. So that's sort of like the strategy you're taking on that. That's one channel, but I guess this is a good suggestion takeaway for anyone who's listening from marketing side of thing. If there's a freebie, there's a book, or there's any sort of thing that's been created. So your suggestion there is to kind of break that into pieces and sort of share that. That can just be your content strategy for quite a while, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is so useful to be able to do that because, you know, you spent a lot of time on this book. Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time on whatever it is you're doing, and you're a subject matter expert. And I think for me, the tricky part was so much of this is so intuitive for me because I've done it for so long. And so it felt like I was telling people things that they should just know. But then I realized, no, this is just kind of my specialty. And I think so often the thing we're really good at, we kind of take it for granted. But really, that's why we're good at it, because we've become good at it. We put in our 10,000 hours. So I found it to be very useful. And if you have a book, book talk is a great hashtag because it really gets you right to the right people.
Nice. With that, I didn't ask, like, how long you've been doing just the coaching aspect of the things, working with clients? How long?
I guess 2014, somewhere in there. That's when I started the coaching and the talks pretty much at the same time. Okay. Because as soon as I started coaching, I started getting speaking gigs. So, and now with my book, you know, people really want me to just keynote on the book. So
I'm sure,
which is really so amazing and fun and incredible. And I love it. Yeah. And I love meeting people, and I make connections I hold on to forever, which is also just wonderful. So it's a really, I mean, if you're an extrovert, I am an extrovert, and you love people, it's an awesome job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Going out, meeting people and getting paid for that. So that's amazing part.
You have to talk about the stuff you love and then talk to people about it and meet great people. I mean, I couldn't be luckier.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that book, like, I'm curious, it's first of all, phenomenal job in making that as a best-selling book, writing that book. But was there any special sort of push/marketing that you did, or was it sort of kind of organic and through your connections and social?
Yeah, I actually had a publicist, which I highly recommend. Nowadays with books, they don't push your book out. They just don't. There's something called Made Books, which is maybe 20 books out of the whole publishing house, and they are made books. And if you're not one of the made books, and you kind of have to be Michelle Obama to be a made book, they're not, you're going to push your own stuff out. And so you have to do it. I mean, I did, I'd say maybe 60 podcasts before my launch. I was on various TV. I had a People magazine story done on me. I mean, you just have to push and push because people just don't read books anymore. Right. And so in order to get a book out there, you really need to have a book that people can see. And for me, I actually wrote the book in a way that I thought was more digestible. I have ADHD, like really badly ADHD. So I know for me, having a book that has, you can open it up and just read any part of it, And then you can put it down because it's a guidebook. It has, mm-hmm. you know, it goes from posture to imposter syndrome to, you know, mansplaining. I mean, it's just all of the things. And so if you don't have to read it all at once. So I also tried to make a book that was really accessible, which also gave me the flexibility to talk to anybody about anything because it's just a guidebook. So the stuff that I didn't know for the book, I luckily, because of the community I live in, Ithaca, New York, I have huge access to Ivy League professors and experts in all of the things. So if somebody didn't have it here, they'd refer me to their friend at Harvard. And so mm-hmm. I just had all these wonderful experts that I got to talk to. And so there's nothing in the book at this point. Most things, if you ask me about it, it's probably in my book because it's just a guidebook. It's nice. You know, instead of one deep dive, it's everything about everything.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, no, that's great suggestion just from a push standpoint, promoting the book, because you're right, like most of these publishing houses have stopped doing that big book launches for yeah. newer writers, especially, and you have to be like someone very established and a few successful books under the belt.
Yeah, I coach awesome. People on that, actually. I coach people on how to get your book published because there is an entire, you know, and I actually have it on my Medium. I haven't been doing much with Medium lately. I should be doing more with Medium, but I do have some basic steps on how to get ready to launch your book, which is because I think it needs to be democratized. I had to pay a lot of money to get that information. And I thought everybody yeah. should have this. So
absolutely.
There are steps you can take or you can get a coach to get you through the process because there are ways to do it, but you really have to be tactical.
Gotcha. Awesome. Talk to us. Another question I have, which we were talking earlier, talk to us about your latest project. I know you're a multitasker and you do quite a few things. Your latest project, Think Twice Labs, talk to us about it. What is it? What it is about and what's in it?
So the woman who wrote my foreword is the former chief marketing officer of Cirque du Soleil. So she's the former CMO of Cirque du Soleil, and she's incredible. And we had a lot, we became friends during the launch. Most of the time you have a forward writer and they just are like, see ya, here's the forward. Mm-hmm. But we became friends. She did all of these events with me. Her name is Alma Derricks. She's incredible. She has a company called Rev. And if you look her up, you're not going to get anyone better. She did the Dilbert brand. I don't know if you remember Dilbert, but I can't figure out how yep. that was popular. Well, that was her. She nice. Figured nice. It out. So we were talking a lot about how a lot of the problems that leadership has to do with the fact that we're in this new situation in the workplace where there are all different kinds of people. And instead of looking at it like, oh, this is a real problem. How are we going to navigate this? We think, how can you capitalize on this? Because the more voices that you have, the better things are going to go. So we do kind of this hybrid of communication and leadership training, and we do it with top companies, with leaders. And it's just been, she worked at Deloitte. I mean, she, luckily we have some contacts through her, but it's just an incredibly powerful program called Think Twice. And it's obviously with the whole idea of how do you get in a situation and not just be reactive, but make sure you're optimizing all of your employees and how do you think twice, and what are the steps? And there are all kinds of different, there's basically a multi-step process that we've developed, and it's really exciting and it works really well.
Nice. That's awesome. And you also do workshops. I think you touched on that as well. So workshops are kind of in-person, virtual, group setting. Talk to us about that as well.
Yeah, we teach teams how to optimize their communication. That's what I do. I use the macro public speaking as a diagnostic tool to diagnose micro communication issues. And so people leave with better public speaking skills. But the public speaking to me is speaking in front of a ton of people, speaking at a meeting, speaking to your boss, you know, and now you're in the workplace having a conversation. Because the truth is, if you and I were just talking in my house with wine, we would not be talking this way.
Right.
This is our public face, right? It's not
right.
exactly the same. We're not swearing. I bet you swear once in a while. I know I do. I'm Italian. So we do have a bit of a public face we use. And so the work that I do is how do you basically optimize and be authentic with your public face and make it the most powerful you can possibly make it. And so it's a really fun workshop. I love doing them. And then I do talks on claiming space and all the aspects of claiming space. So when people leave my talks, they're better communicators, but they also have more confidence and they're better equipped to deal with things like microaggressions, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then the other project I'm doing, which I do have to plug, is with this woman, Fernanda Carapina, who started We Global Studios. And she and I are doing something called the Athena Code, which is actually directed just for women on basically blowing your mindset. So she does the internal part of mindset change and I do the external part of how do you present physically. And it's, we're about to launch it and it's going to be really, really exciting. So if you go to my website, you'll get information on it.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations on that. Launching those new projects lately. And then with that, which you touched on, if someone wants to reach out, wants to find more information on these workshops, projects, where should they find you and these things?
I always feel like a telemarketer when I do that. Like, well, you can find me, but it is true. You can find me. So you can find me on any social media platform, although I'm god awful on Twitter. So, you know, good luck with that if that's your only platform. But please share my stuff. I still haven't figured out how to do Twitter. But you can find me on Twitter, on all the platforms. I have a pretty big following on TikTok. And you can also go to my website. I do not spam people. I do not send newsletters all the time that are annoying and boring, but I do send occasional newsletters. Like, for example, I have work with Brompton Bicycle on women's health. And anybody who goes through my website can get huge discounts. And I get no money from that. This is me actually just trying to promote health. So so they're fun. You know, you get little perks when you join my community on my website. So, perfect. You know, it's a good way to kind of stay in touch.
Awesome. Well, that was great talking to you. I really appreciate your time, Eliza. And I'm sure our listeners had very solid takeaways there, and we touched a lot of things from your book standpoint, and then kind of having that confidence, and then sharing the story about your son, and kind of also on a lot on the business side of things. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. I really enjoyed talking to you, and with that, good luck with your new projects, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.